Hi, I'm Maeve Doyle, and you're listening to A Private View. On today's show, we are having a dialogue between artist Jordi Kerwick, who is painting for an upcoming show called Be Sure to Never Get Where We're Going. And the paintings he's showing in the show are hanging alongside the Al Safo flags from Peter Alder's Pebble London collection. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Maeve.
Hello.
Jordi, if I were to ask you who you are and what you do, how would you answer it?
I would say I'm a 41-year-old fella, lives in France from Australia originally, and a very proud father of two boys and proud husband of a lovely wife and a very simple person. That's what I'd say. And I make paintings, which is a pretty good vocation. Pretty happy, pretty lucky about that.
Peter, who are you and what do you do?
Oof. Well, I was born in the States, in California. I grew up, I had my fifth birthday in London, so we moved to London. My dad was a musician, and from a very early age, I was absolutely obsessed with music. And then I went to school in England, in Devon, and started to paint and sculpt and act and write more music. And that by this time, I was very involved in modern art and also in modern jazz. And when I went up to university, I joined a band and we had some hit records in Ireland. And then we had a big hit in America with the worst song I ever wrote. And so we started touring America. And I became fascinated in America by originally American Indian culture and craft. And when I had time off from the tour, I used to go to the reservations and buy textiles and jewelry, et cetera, from the Indians. When I became more aware of Africa, aesthetically, I became less interested in American Indian. And so I ended up writing two books on African textiles, one of which was The Flags. And I was a dealer in tribal art. And then I was with a girlfriend in India about 20 years ago, and I totally fell in love with India. And we went there because she wanted to design a clothes collection. And when I saw the workshops of the jewelers, particularly in Jaipur and Rajasthan, I decided I wanted to make jewelry. But my aesthetic was definitely tribal. And then eventually Henrietta, my girlfriend, and I did the collections together. That started Pebble London, which is our jewelry company.
Sometimes I think when I've been getting ready for this and talking to Jordi and looking at his amazing paintings that are coming up for the show that opens on April 10th at Karl Kostel in Milan, I think to myself that you live in a world that he imagines and tries to paint.
Oh, that's very kind. I'm not sure. I think it certainly isn't a tribute to minimalism, that's for sure.
Maximalist, the nth degree, endlessly fascinating and full of joy. And I think getting to know Jordi and realizing what, and I'm putting words in your mouth, Jordi, so stop me if I'm wrong, his ideal response to his work by anybody would be, wow. And I think that's what happens when you walk into Peter's house. You're just speechless.
All I see is mess and chaos, but you're very kind.
And what about what I just said regarding the way people respond to your paintings? Am I fairly right? Because if I were talking to you about deeper meanings and symbolism and postmodernist theories, that wouldn't interest you at all, would it?
No, not much. I mean, it's hard. I think it's like anything you do in life. Some things have more profound meanings than others. It is possible to make a cool painting that doesn't have a lot of meaning, and it's possible to make a painting that is packed with symbolism, cultural references, family, you know, the way I'm feeling. So, yeah, bit of both.
I think part of the thing that when Catherine curated the show so cleverly, that with the 100 years between when the flags were made and your work, that's remarkable, is the nonverbal storytelling that happens from protest in the flags. And with you, it's, Jordi, I think yours are a little bit in trying to figure out how to live an interior life.
Bizarrely enough, I love making those paintings, but the art that we live with is generally, a lot of it is abstract minimalism. So we live with the opposite. Probably because we spend so much time with the maximum in our, or the maximal approach in my studio, and my wife's very similar. So
What did you think when you saw the flags?
Oh, I saw them. I bought one when I was still living in Australia, so years and years and years ago. And I saw there was, art though it's reputational. And for me, I saw a little bit of Matisse. I guess that's what drew me first, because Matisse is he's my idol in every way, shape, and form. He's a good family man, and he obviously a creative genius. And he went backwards to move forwards, through his cutouts. And I think I first was attracted by that, the idea of the cutouts, even though they predate Matisse. A lot of the flags that Peter discussed previously, they predate Matisse and his work. So I think that was what I really enjoyed at first glance.
I think it's interesting that Peter is not just a fan of your work, but he started collecting these flags. What's this? The story goes back decades, doesn't it, Peter?
Yeah, no, I bought my first flag at a, I think it was must have been 40 years ago, at a minor Christie's sale. Christie's South Kensington had a sale of tribal art, and that's what I was really involved with at the time. But in terms of tribal art, I always favored the craft of tribal cultures rather than the sculpture or the masks, which are traditionally, obviously, people associate with the tribal cultures. And there was a flag, and I absolutely fell in love with it and bought it. And a man approached me and told me that his grandfather or great grandfather had been a district officer in Ghana at the end of the 19th century and had brought back to the UK a collection of 46 flags. Would I be interested in seeing them with a view to buying them each for the same price that I had paid for the one? And I said, well, I'd love to see them. When I saw them, I'd never ever seen a flag before. And I thought, this is unbelievable craft movement. So I bought the collection and then let the word out amongst all the textile dealers, the tribal dealers, that I was in the market for Asafo flags. And they all went, thank God somebody wants to buy these things, because they didn't know what to do with them. Because from a strict tribal point of view, a purist point of view, there's so much European influence there. Well, obviously, the flag format is European, that it's not pure tribal, but that they were ignoring the visual power of those flags and the fact that they're all narrative. They're all telling proverbs or describing historical events or identifying with a symbol of strength, be it European, like an airplane or a lion or a mythological creature. And the fact that they are all narrative is what really attracted me, but obviously, particularly the beauty and the way they use color and imagery.
It's funny because I've been doing a little bit of research into flags in general and flags in painting and why this show is so appealing to me. And I think the flag is a funny one because it's both an object and a concept.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the proverbs and symbolism and myths that are being passed through the flags are real and can be decoded. I think you've written a book on it, haven't you, Peter?
That was originally going to be a book. Tom Mashler, I don't know if you know of him. He was a publisher. But poor Tom, he got very, very ill. And the first exhibition of the flags was about to open at the Royal Festival Hall. And there was no book. And Thames and Hudson had always been waiting in the wings. They wanted to do the book. And when I called Tom, and I had no idea he was ill, his secretary told me. And I went to see him in hospital, and he said, no, by all means, you know how much I want to do the book, but I can't. So go with Thames and Hudson. And to their credit, they put that book together very, very quickly because they needed to.
Geordie, have you seen the book? And I'm guessing because a lot of your work seems to have a narrative that I know is personal to you and works maybe with some of the similar objects or subjects or animals that the Asafo flags have. Do you have any questions for Peter? He seems to have endless stories about his adventures as a collector. In fact, anyone who wondered about collecting only has to meet Peter to want to start collecting everything. It's such an enthusiasm.
You have to remember, I have a very fertile imagination. And if I can't answer a question, I just make it up.
Well, in the
So,
spirit of storytelling, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Exactly.
I've made a career out of it, Peter. So I'm with you, mate. So to answer a question, man, yeah, I do. I have an Asafo flag book. I wanted to make sure I understood the meaning and get some of the visual, a greater visual understanding when I committed to the show with Carl and Catherine, and then subsequently have included the book into a painting, albeit slightly edited, just to have Peter's name.
Which is very kind of you, by the way. I'm thrilled. Well, actually, I'm particularly thrilled to that painting you gave me. It's the most incredible, generous gift, and I completely love it.
I'm so glad, mate. Peter, I guess one of the questions I had for you were, when you first discovered them, did it take you a period of time, or did you have to really grow? Or was it one of those things that you looked at and you knew straight away that this was for you, this was a artistic pursuit worth really delving into? Or did you have to gain some sort of historic background before jumping in and committing to, what is now turned into a career of collection and storytelling and growth through the flags?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, and as I said, I bought the first one I ever saw, and that was the one at the Christie sale. But when I saw the collection that the man who'd put it into the sale, that his grandfather or great grandfather had collected, when I saw the 46 flags, then I realized this was an incredible craft movement. And the fact that it was all narrative is what really attracted me. Obviously, visually was what first attracted me, the way they used color and imagery. But then when I started to research it, initially at the British Museum, who have quite a good collection of flags. And then UCLA has a very good collection. And the more I researched and discovered the history of the flags, they go back to the 17th century, I mean, documented.
It's amazing.
As soon as the Europeans went into what became known as the Gold Coast, that 80 miles of coastline on the Ghanaian coast, they were making the Fanti were making flags based upon European flags and banners, but obviously none exist today, so we don't know what they look like. But there are descriptions of travelers of that period, and unquestionably there were Sappho flags going back to the 17th century.
Have you seen an evolution in scale, in subject matter, in palette? Like, have you seen evolution, or is it something they've maintained to be quite traditional and they've kept in within a particular realm in the development?
Yeah, no, I think there's no history of the written word in Akan culture, and all the laws and the legends, et cetera, were passed down through basically proverbs. And there's over 2,000 proverbs that have been identified amongst the Akan people, of which the Fanti are one member of that group. But it's the Fanti that probably about 200 proverbs are used regularly in flag imagery. But of course, there's another whole group of flags that describe historical events. And then there's another group that identifies with images of strength, i.e., the lion, mythological creature, et cetera, or European technology. But yes, they haven't really developed in any way, but they have reproduced, and different schools of flag makers have interpreted it quite differently, the same proverb. And you can see that in the book. There are various examples of how different flag makers have interpreted exactly the same proverb.
And also, something I want to ask both of you is the imagery that Geordie's using is similar to a certain extent, and yet it looks contemporary. So the fact that the Fanti flags they seem very modern, makes me think there's a sense of timelessness to the storytelling, that they've hooked onto some shapes and forms and a composition that doesn't seem to look dated. For instance, I was at an old master's show earlier today, and it doesn't look contemporary at all, yet the Fanti flags do look contemporary.
Absolutely. But we know they go back to the 17th century. Sadly, we don't have any of those flags to see because they got destroyed over the centuries.
Geordie, can you see your work in the flags? Because I can, from the bright colors to the borders to the kind of storytelling to this idea of bringing the jungle or bringing the outside to the inside.
Yeah, no, I definitely can. I think that, well, like my work, they're 2D and they're flat. I think that's one of the first things you sort of, that's the comparison. Strong sense of pattern and textile in a lot of them, with the inclusion of the Union Jack. There's consistency in the approach. I mean, I'd love to know if the Union Jack was put in there as a center point, then you'd create the subject matter around that center point. So the Unijack's always there as a point of reference in rebellion, and then you tell your story through the other figures. I don't know if that's actually factual, or that's just my interpretation, I guess.
What's very interesting is that if you, many of the flags, they, as you say, they have different versions of the Union Jack. And believe me, they knew exactly what the Union Jack should look like. So I think this was a not so subtle message. You may think you run this country, but you don't. So they do some wild interpretations of the British Ensign. In fact, actually, there are other flags that have the Danish flag on them, because there are many Europeans that built trading forts along that coast. The first were the Portuguese. And I think in 1471, they sailed down the Atlantic coast. And the day they dropped anchor completely changed the life of the Fanti, because they were a coastal community. They were basically fishermen. But as soon as the Europeans got established, the Fanti came to them really for protection against their larger neighbors and enemies, the Ashanti. The Ashanti Empire was the most powerful in Ghana, and they were bitter enemies of the Fanti, who were much smaller. So they went to the Europeans really for protection. But in the doing so, they picked up a lot of European, especially military technology and tradition, in marching in procession, wearing of uniforms and flags and banners, which they not only hung them, but they danced them, incredible provocative dances, mainly to antagonize rival Dassafo companies. I mean, they all had a common enemy, which was the Ashanti, but the squabbles between different Dassafo companies, which often led to quite serious bloodshed. So in 1880, the British governor at Cape Coast demanded that all the companies handed in their flags, and they had to be registered with him or his secretary. And it was against the law to dance an unapproved flag, so it didn't antagonize a rival company, who would then start killing you for it. Doran Ross, who was a wonderful academic who knew a lot about this, he wrote a pamphlet called "Fighting with Art" about the flags. He's probably the greatest authority on the flags.
Geordie, I can see what Peter's talking about with the flags in your work. However, it's not a war. It's a domestic sort of way of living investigation or how to be with each other, how to live with charm. There's still magical creatures. I know part of, I don't want to say your protest, but part of what you're questioning is whether the eye should be overeducated, if there's any merit in that.
Yeah, I think so. I think with every single thing in life, there is a multitude of reasons that you do or do not do something. There's never one reason. That's what I've sort of learned as I'm getting older, and I'd like to think wiser, but also probably not getting wiser. I like the idea. I think, again, drawing the similarity between my work and the Asafo flags, is there is a sophisticated simplicity within the work. We look at it, and there might be a crocodile, and there might be a tree. And a character, and then you've got the Union Jack and these beautiful patterns and a lovely palette. The people that made that particular work, obviously there was a motive and there was a reason. But secondary that, there was also an artistic output. And they also felt like there's something innate in them that wanted to make that. And I feel like lots of paintings, and it depends on the painting you look at. For me, it's exactly the same. Sometimes just because you want to, and other times it's because you've had a shitty day, or you challenge yourself and see if you can create a character that suits the narrative that you're trying to create. So I guess it's the multiple reasonings behind making something that means something to me. But I mean, ultimately though, if someone looks at it and aesthetically it looks cool and it's interesting, like that's equally as important or equally as rewarding as making something which has depths of meaning and layers of toil and hardship and all that sort of stuff. So that's what I like about the Asafo, because they're so simple and yet they're unbelievably sophisticated, unbelievably.
Yeah, I mean, the whole famous thing is simple is never easy. And maybe that's where the timeless quality comes from.
No, I'd agree with that for sure. I mean, you could send those out. I think I mentioned it in the last discussion we had, but you could send those out in a spaceship, and along with all the mathematical equations and a few Asafo flags, and whatever being encountered that, if there are things out there, that tells a story. There would be some sort of interpretation of what they were viewing, what they were seeing, and that's incredibly hard to do. That's really challenging.
Yeah, and it breaks down language barriers. It's also a universal language. Anyone can read it in a sense on some level.
Absolutely. And that's the genius of the Asafo flag, really.
And of your work.
Well, I don't
I
know about
agree. I agree. I agree.
that,
I agree.
but thank you, Peter.
And although you say your work is personal and it's about you and your family and you know what you're doing and you're going to protect your privacy on that, which I respect immensely, I can still look at it and read things into it, which makes me think as human beings, we all kind of deal with a lot of the same issues.
Yeah, we're basically all the same. We're just people. We're all just people. We all have good qualities and bad. We all have abject failures and successes. And the pursuit of perfection is a very rough and unfulfilling one, because we are innately imperfect. That's what being human is. I guess it's just the strive to be better. But yeah, no, I'm just a person, and we're all just people.
And the pursuit of perfection can rob your life of a lot of joy.
Absolutely. And that's why I've got sausage fingers, and you can see it in my art.
But I think creating a world with magical animals and two-headed beasts and Peter, you collecting them says a lot about how both of you value not only creativity, but your imaginations.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that the more I researched the flags, the fact that there was no written anything written in the Akan culture, the fact they had to transmit a proverbial message so that it could be easily read by anybody in that community using no words, that was quite a challenge, and I think they achieved it brilliantly. That was the real thing.
Jordi, about the tribes, the clans, there's a sense of that with you. You talk about your family a lot. So even why they're made.
Yeah. So when I was seven, my family, we moved to Hong Kong. We used to live in Hong Kong. And I think with expatriation, when you live somewhere else, you immediately come closer and you become more bonded. So I've got a younger sister and an older sister. They become your best mates when you're taken out of, something or out of your comfort zone. It was always something I wanted to do with my wife, and I had discussed it at, previous points about living overseas. And I think we harbor that same feeling. We moved over here. It was just the four of us, myself, my two sons, and my wife. And then we brought our dogs over. So it's almost like a strengthening exercise. When you take yourself out of that comfort zone, you seem to grow, and the bonds, develop, in a far more, I wouldn't say it's more meaningful, because it's not. It's just, yeah, it's just different. I guess it's different, the way that you come together as a family.
Peter, you've also lived in other countries other than the country you were born in. So have I. And I know what you're talking about in terms of it's not only a great way to get to know your family, but it's a great way to get to know yourself and how to entertain yourself when you don't know anyone, which usually is through something like a collection or something that encourages you to have a rich interior life.
No, absolutely. But I love traveling. I've been so frustrated during COVID, because my greatest joy is going to completely obscure areas of the world in my pursuit of jewelry and whatever. I mean, India, you could travel in India for the rest of your life and you wouldn't scratch it. But I used to go 4 times a year regularly. And I tried to divide it between half the time there creating a new collection of jewelry and the other half by going to somewhere I'd never been before. But that applies to all over the world.
And then the things you bring back remind you of where you were traveling, I'm guessing.
Oh, sure. But I also always, I still do, try to work with local materials, and I work with local workshops. So we work in India, we work in Thailand, we work in Africa, we work in South America, Afghanistan, and different countries.
It's funny. And those come to mind when you see the material you get. But I was also thinking then with Jordi's paintings, I just want to revisit this for a second. In a way, they're diary entries of what you're doing in your life at the time. And I only say that because Peter showed up in them, the flag showed up in them, and I'm seeing everything that shows up in them, from the two-headed masks to the lion heads, they all tell the story of what happened that day or at that time in your life.
Absolutely, spot on. Yeah, you could look at a painting and dissect it down to what I was listening to, the squabble I've had with my wife, the what I was reading, how I was my general mental health in that particular, that particular period. I think you can always, yeah, you can delve down. There's never just, like I was saying before, there's never just one reason to do something. There's layers and layers and multitudes of reasons that we do it. And yeah, I guess my paintings are no different. They're very cathartic in that sense. You're able to get something off your chest, which is quite lovely.
And you're comfortable with dualities.
Yeah, well, I, yeah, the singularity, I wouldn't know how to, I wouldn't even know how to approach it, to be honest. I'm not sure how I'd even make that happen. I don't know. And then there's also the chance aspect in a painting. So often the palette is wrong, or I'll be painting something and then look around at the other paintings and work at the same time. And that color I've created or the palette just so happens to work at a very particular part of another painting. That was not part of the plan, sorry. It wasn't part of what I was trying to achieve. But I know that there are happy accidents and happy mistakes that force you into a different take a different direction within a painting. So that's again, that adds to the duality. It adds to the, that's another layer of complexity within each painting. Because they very rarely turn out the way you initially plan them.
Yeah, because they're a painting, they're a living thing, and you're
Yeah, you have
working.
a basic vision, and then if you could snapshot that basic vision to, compared to the outcome, it's usually worlds apart.
Geordie, did you know, well, I'm sure you didn't, that the wonderful painting that you gave me, you have a two-headed tiger, and I have two cats who I love more than life itself, who are both Bengals, whose ancestors were tigers, and they are twins, my two cats. And I just thought, how the hell did Geordie know that when he made that painting? Because
Tell them
it's
what their names are. Tell Jordy what their names are.
well, they're both called Mitsu, and I have two cats in Ibiza, and they're also only called me. All my cats have always been called Mitsu. Makes it so much easier. It's called Mitsu, and they all come running.
That's amazing. That's phenomenal.
What can you say about the upcoming show, Be Sure to Never Get Where You're Going, which is such a great title?
Who came up with that wonderful title?
Me. I've got a long list of got like on notes on my phone of just one-liners and things that I'm thinking. And sometimes I'll write them at 11:30 p.m. after a few wines, and then I review them the next day, and they're absolute garbage. At the time, I thought they were genius, and then other times. Yeah, just be something really, really obscure, and I'll just pull my phone out very, very quickly and scribble it down. It's really interesting to challenge yourself on an interesting title and something that resonates with you. So the title for me, I guess, the pursuit. One of my good mates told me that you don't really ever become an artist until you're 90. On your 90th birthday, you can say you're an artist, and I think that's kind of true because you're constantly getting better. You're trying to evolve. You're also failing a lot. I mean, with social media and exhibitions and stuff, you only see the stuff that the artist wants you to see. There is a whole lot of garbage that I've made that no one's ever seen. So I think the idea of resting your laurels as an artist and just going, here's an amazing painting and I'm done, goal achieved. It doesn't happen. It's never gonna happen to me. So these paintings are in the pursuit of something interesting and something that I probably don't really feel worthy in terms of the Asafo flags. They're incredibly culturally important and artistically brilliant. There's something that we'd all like to achieve within them as an artist, the simplicity and the sophistication. So I thought it was an apt title for what we're about to do together.
But what I always loved were kids' paintings. I mean, I still do. And at one point, I went to the local art schools in London and said, can we do exhibitions? Because children see so directly and they paint absolutely what they see. And years ago, I bought a collection of tiny little cigarette pack type paintings from a man called, well, General Pitt Rivers, who had a museum, built a museum at Oxford. But his the lady who married his son made this collection, and they would get all the people working on the Pitt Rivers estate, be they 3 years old or 70 years old, to all paint the same horse they'll be standing. And What I noticed was all the three-year-olds saw that horse exactly in the same way in terms of what they saw as important. And then six-year-olds, more sophisticated, 10-year-olds going right up to 70-year-olds. So, but what I love was the childhood directness of kids when they paint. They have absolutely no holdback. And I always thought, maybe Geordie wouldn't agree with this, but I think artists, a lot of them spend their entire professional lives trying to get back to that childhood state of seeing directly. Does that make any kind of sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
The show opens on Wednesday, the 10th of April. It's called Be Sure to Never Get Where You're Going. It's in Catherine and Carl's house, which is going to be listed in one of the architectural magazines this month or next. That's how I think historic and beautiful that particular building is. If you're in Milan, go see this show. Otherwise, gentlemen, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much. It's so lovely speaking to you both. It's been really, really lovely.
And look forward to seeing you in Milan.
I'll be there.
Here we are. Excellent.
You've been listening to Maeve Doyle's Private View. This podcast is produced by Will Fitzpatrick at Soho Radio. The music is by Khurshid Homi. Thank you for listening.